There, now it's recording. Now we're recording.
We hope.
And the battery is not entirely full, and I assume the light goes out and we will have a gap in the recording if the battery dies during this session, and if it doesn't, I will switch battery before the next class. All right. I wanted to briefly review the ex ante ex post way of thinking about lots of things, which you can think of as the difference between controlling input and output, or if you like, rewarding or punishing input or output. It's a very common theme if you're thinking about how you compensate employees, but I want to argue that it's also an important element if you're thinking about how legal roles work. The advantage to doing things based on the output is that it's a lot easier to say the accident occurred and did this much damage than to say the way you were driving has one chance to 723 of doing such and such an amount of damage. So it's easier to observe what's happened than what's expected to happen. Furthermore, in controlling the actions in advance, the advantage of having the actor himself control it rather than having some outside person try to punish behavior he disapproves of is that the actor at least has much better information about what he is himself doing than any traffic policeman can reasonably hope to have. I know that I have not been paying attention because, you know, 10 miles just went by and I didn't notice because I was thinking about something else. There's no way that the traffic cop can know that. In addition, the actor not only can see what he's doing, he probably has private information about himself that the legal system, which has to treat him as sort of an average person, isn't going to have. But that could be a disadvantage if we think the private information is wrong, if everybody believes he's a very skillful driver, and so what if he had two cans of beer? It's no problem. The advantage to input, I think the two advantages I can see are, first, that it can get its effects with smaller punishments imposed more often, and it's at least typically, though not inevitably, the case that you can make smaller punishments more efficient by using fines rather than things like imprisonment. And if people are risk averse, then even smaller fines are more efficient than larger fines because you don't have the risk aversion cost. And one critical point to notice is that when I say more efficient, I don't just mean that the cost, that the deadweight cost, the cost, the net cost of imprisoning somebody is higher than the net cost of a $10 fine. I mean that it's higher by more than the punishment is higher. So if you think of a $10 fine as having a 10-cent cost of collecting it, or whatever your bank pays to pass the credit card or whatever it is, that's a 1 in 100, or 1% of the punishment represents cost, whereas for imprisonment, 150 or 200% of the punishment is cost, since nobody gets what the person who's imprisoned loses, and someone's got to pay for the prison. So the critical distinction is that by less efficient, I mean less efficient per unit of deterrence, per unit of punishment. The other possible advantage to input is if you believe the court knows the causal relationships better than the individual actor. For example, if you believe that the court correctly thinks that after two cans of beer you're not a safe driver and that many people overestimate themselves and think they are, then that could be an advantage. It's also a disadvantage, of course, if the court has less accurate information about those. In practice, a lot of legal rules do both. Have both ex post and ex ante elements, and indeed I was suggesting earlier that perhaps for large effects the optimum is usually the combination, because you can't get as large a deterrence as you want by an ex post punishment without making it so high as to be very costly, so you have a not too high ex post punishment plus some ex ante. And as I pointed out, this whole distinction I'm making is a little ambiguous, and sometimes the output of one stage of your decision process is the input to another. Questions on that stuff? Just going over it last time. Attempts. I want to argue that one way of understanding the law against attempts is that it's a version of an ex ante punishment on the grounds that shooting at people is an ex ante form of behavior which raises the probability of hitting them.
and that you can then think of it as a, that if you have a $10,000 fine for doing something and a $5,000 fine for trying and failing, that you can think of that as a $5,000 ex ante punishment for attempting and an additional $5,000 ex post for succeeding. I raised the question, which I don't know if any of you thought about or not, but I found it interesting to think about, if you think about it in terms of moral philosophy, not economics, whether it makes sense to punish people more, less severely for a failed attempt than for a successful attempt, because if the punishment is thought of what they deserve, you've shown yourself to be just as bad a person by aiming and missing as by aiming and hitting. And that, I think, is, I find, the sort of thing where I find it interesting to interrogate my own intuition, so that I say, if I discovered that a friend of mine had run down a small child driving drunk, how would that affect my feeling about him? How about if I discovered that he had almost run down a small child when driving drunk and the child had gotten out of the way? And the answer is I'd feel much less badly about him in the second case. Hard to know whether one should. And as I may have mentioned, the best discussion of this issue I think I could find when I was reading up on it for an article I was writing on something many years ago is actually in Adam Smith's first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is what the title suggests. It's an attempt to understand our moral feelings. And he observes this pattern, argues that it's irrational, that we ought to judge people by basically what they are, not by the external accidents that determine the effect, but that it's fortunate we feel this way because we're not competent to judge what people are and we're all biased, and whereas we are competent to observe what happens. So that sort of part of what I found interesting in the difference between the 18th century and the modern viewpoint is that the modern, I think, is inclined to say, if we realized how much of the effect was external random things, we wouldn't blame people as much. And Smith says, no, it's the other way around. We would say, look, we should hang all the Catholics, because although that particular Catholic doesn't happen to have killed anybody, everybody knows that if the Pope tells Catholics to kill people, they will. This is in Protestant England after the Catholics had lost out, and therefore that's an excuse for punishing them in advance for being wicked enough people such that if the Pope told them to murder the King of England, they would. And I don't remember if that's his example, but the basic tone of his argument is that if our intuition said we can punish people for being bad people instead of for doing bad things, given human biases, that would have very bad consequences. We feel entitled to punish people we thought were bad people. So he ends up concluding that our irrational moral intuitions are evidence of divine benevolence, that God has made us with this particular form of irrationality to avoid the undesirable consequences. I thought it was a really neat and clever argument. But I like Smith. My cell phone number is 666-1776, entirely by chance, I should say. And when I tell people that, their reaction, of course, isn't that neat, 1776. And I say, yeah, that was a really important date. I mean, that was the date of publication of The Wealth of Nations. There were also some troubles in the colonies that year, but that's not really important. Anyway. All right. Impossible attempts are then an interesting issue, which I think I've actually published something on. And it starts out as sort of this voodoo killer story. The question is, should you punish someone who sticks pins in a voodoo doll? And when you think it through, you say, well, there's a sense in which all failed attempts are sticking pins in a voodoo doll, because given the exact circumstances that happened, aiming my gun right there and pulling the trigger wasn't going to kill anybody because I was a degree off in where I was aiming. And you then say, all right, it really becomes a question of what people know. That if what the rule says is trying to kill people with voodoo isn't punishable, all that'll do is encourage people who wanted to commit murder and believe in voodoo to use voodoo, which is a fine thing because it won't do as much damage as other things they could try. On the other hand, if the legal rule is impossible attempts don't count, which seems much more likely given that legal rules usually are broader than specifying a particular method, then somebody who is thinking about a method that might be impossible, where he's not sure if the stuff he's got is really cyanide or blue food coloring because he's not sure he trusts his supplier, may say to himself, well, look, if it's cyanide, I kill him. If it's blue food coloring, I don't kill him, but at least nothing happens to me. Whereas a legal rule which said even impossible attempts are criminal, he would say, well, if it's blue food coloring, not only do I not kill him, there's some chance I'll get caught. And the result will be to get me punished. It's interesting from the standpoint of the lawyer, I suppose. Could you argue that putting blue food coloring in your enemy's drink is attempted murder by an impossible means and therefore perhaps not punished? But trying to buy cyanide in order to put it in his drink was a possible means, because it's possible the guy really has cyanide, so you said so it was attempted when you bought it and an impossible attempt when you did it. Anyway, let that go. So, all right, let's go on to game theory, which is our subject for today. And game theory is a really neat, really interesting subject, which I think occupies too large a part of economics and has for a few decades now. And that as I see it at least, it's a very interesting set of ideas. The problem is that economists thought they could use it to make economic arguments more rigorous than they are, and mostly I think they can't. And so that sort of becomes a dead end. But anyway, so what's the basic problem is strategic behavior. The problem is other people. Everybody knows that's the problem. Other people don't do what you want them to. And in strategic behavior, I'm not just saying they're doing X, Y, and Z, what shall I do? They're saying they're watching me, I'm watching them. What I do will affect what they do will affect what I do. This looks a whole lot more like a game than it is like dealing with nature. And if you think of strategic behavior in general, it applies to an awful lot of human activities. It's not just games in our usual sense, but if you think about the game between attorneys and litigation, where you're saying, you know, when should I bring out what evidence, what motions should I make, should I hire that extra expert witness, all sorts of stuff like that, should I make a settlement offer, should I accept a settlement offer, all of that is strategic behavior. Could easily enough imagine the case where you say, well, really, we'd be better off settling for $100,000. But they'd be better off if we settled for $50,000, because after all, lawyers are expensive, so let's offer them $50,000. And of course, the guy on the other side can say, well, it's true, $50,000 is better than we're going to do at trial after we allow for costs, but it's an awful lot better than they can do, so we ought to ask for $100,000. So that's all of that is games. When and if any of you are parents, are any of you parents yet? Not as far as you know. That a lot of the interaction between parents and children is strategic behavior, that the parents want children to behave in certain ways, children want parents to behave in certain ways, and so forth. Any bargaining is really strategic behavior, and so forth. One of the things that struck me thinking about game theory is the efforts economics goes to avoid it. And this goes long back before there was any game theory, but to avoid strategic behavior. So that part of the way economics works is to try to set up problems in ways that don't have strategic behavior in them. Because if there's no strategic behavior, what we have is a maximization problem. We have is the same thing that an engineer would have where you say, all right, here are the facts, what should I do to maximize my objectives? And I don't have to worry about the fact that my doing that is going to shift the facts because other people are responding. So that a simple example is that sort of the basic model in economics, the one that we're most comfortable with, is perfect competition. What's perfect competition? It's an economy where there are so many firms or individuals producing each good that each of them knows that how much he produces won't affect anybody else. That I'm maybe producing one millionth of the world's wheat, so if I double my output, any effect on the world price of wheat is going to be so small I'm not going to notice it. Right? So that's one virtue of perfect competition, one reason why it's a useful way of thinking about economies, even though it's a very imperfect description, is that we can solve it. We can figure out what the answers are because it avoids strategic behavior. But it's also true that the standard economic model of monopoly, the opposite of perfect competition, also avoids strategic behavior because the normal monopoly assumption is there's one monopolist and lots of customers. So the customers say, well, the monopolist does whatever he does, and my behavior isn't going to change what he does. And the monopolist says, I know the customers aren't really trying to strategically influence me because they know that each of them is too small to affect me, so I can just say, I can predict what the customers will do in response to whatever price I set, what price will maximize my profit. So those are both sort of the two extremes of standard economic theory, both of them popular with authors of textbooks, and for the good reason that they're things we can actually solve. We can figure out what will happen. However, there are lots of things in the world that don't fit that pattern. Bilateral monopoly, which is when you have one buyer and one seller, which we'll be getting into, doesn't fit that pattern. oligopoly where you have lots and lots of buyers and six sellers doesn't fit that pattern because each of the sellers is watching the others. I've been doing extensive experimentation on this subject in recent weeks because I've been selling stuff on the auction house in World of Warcraft, and it's quite intriguing to watch the way you've got what are pretty clearly explicit or implicit cartels in everybody setting the same price, and then somebody setting the price, you know, 5 cents below it, as it were, and then it slides down, and then they manage to reestablish at some point. But you can see it's a neat case because it's a very simple prediction that you would get from the perfect competition model, and the prediction isn't true if you watch that particular market. All right? So when all else fails, game theory is a way of thinking about the issues where you do have to look at strategic behavior. And what is game theory trying to do? The first step really is to describe a game. And ideally, you'd like to describe all games with one description. Can't quite get that far, but we can get pretty far in that direction. You would like to define what the solution of a game means. And then you would like to know how to find the solution to a game. So if you think about sort of a really ambitious project, if you were the smartest man in the 20th century, which maybe von Neumann was, it's not clear, and you wanted a challenging job, that's it. Find a way of describing all strategic behavior, all games. Find a definition of what the solution to a game means, and tell us, you know, how do you write the computer program that will solve any game? That's the project. What is the solution to a game? Not at all clear what that even means. It might mean a description of how every player ought to play, but it's a little tricky to know what that means because how I ought to play depends partly on how you're playing. It might mean a prediction of what people will do. There's a term that bridge players use, at least used to use, stealing candy from babies. And stealing candy from babies means doing things that wouldn't be the right thing to do against a really good player, but that work well given that your opponent's not a very good player. Typically, game theory is not dealing with the sort of calculational problem of, given the limits of the human brain, how do I approximate the right strategy? The tendency is to say, if you could perfectly analyze this problem, if you imagine you've got an unlimited supply of powerful computers, how would you play? So that one of the counterintuitive results is that chess is a trivial game. That chess is a solved game, we can tell you exactly how to play perfectly, all we require is the infinitely powerful computer to do the calculations. Because how do you play chess perfectly? You start by looking at all possible chess games. That's a finite, though very large number. And you say, all right, for every possible chess game, look at the last move. If white makes the last move and the result that is that he loses, he shouldn't make that move, sort of run back up the tree, and you eventually get a statement of how each player should play, given the other one's going to play perfectly, and presumably if you could actually do it, you could find out whether chess is a win for white, a win for black, or always a stalemate. But tic-tac-toe, as those of you who have played it probably know, is always a stalemate if you play perfectly, but it's got many fewer alternatives than chess. And then how does one describe a game in a way sufficiently general to work for all games? And it turns out that you can, in fact, describe all two-player games in a single way, which is very useful if you're trying to do mathematical analysis of them. And the trick is that we define what you're doing not as a move, but as a strategy. So that I say, suppose the game is tic-tac-toe or checkers or chess, doesn't matter. My strategy takes the following form. If I move first, I will do such and such. If the opponent responds in this way, I will do such and such. If he responds in that way, full description of what I will do, whatever he does. Ditto at the next step, next step, next step, all the way to the end of the game. All right. So you can think of a strategy as the description of what you are going to do so complete that if you programmed it into a computer, you could then sit back and the computer would do exactly what you're going to do. And some things, of course, you may not know at the beginning, so that if you imagine you're playing a card game, how does your strategy allow for what's in the other player's hands? And the basic answer is, my strategy starts out with what I know is in my hand and says do such and such, and then at each stage, if the opponent reveals such and such a card, if the dummy comes down, if you're playing bridge and has certain cards, do this. So that the strategy includes responses to all outcomes of random events in the game. Given that we've got a matrix showing all of my possible strategies, any guess of how many possible strategies I might have, say, for chess? What kind of numbers are we thinking about?
Probably larger.
Oh, enormously larger. I wouldn't be surprised if it was one with a billion zeros after. You'd have to work it out. But you know, a billion is a tiny number in this scale. I mean, it's almost certainly more than the number of atoms in the galaxy, say. Chess is a finite game because there are ending rules that basically if nobody moves a pawn or takes a piece for some number of moves, the game's a stalemate. So you can work out the longest possible chess game. I don't know, 5,000 moves or 10,000 moves. At each stage, suppose you've got 10 alternatives. All right, that would give you 10 to the 5,000th options, roughly. So it's not 10 to the billionth, but it's huge. A billion is a little tiny 10 to the 9th, one with 9 zeros. So this is hugely more than that. Anyway, so it's not like it's a practical way of solving the game, but mathematicians don't care about that. If you're proving a theorem, it doesn't really matter whether I is running from 1 to 6 or 1 to a Google. Theorems go through anyway. So you can describe any two-player game by simply writing a matrix, and along the top is one of the players' strategies. Along the bottom is along the sides of the other player's strategy. Each cell is what happens if he's following that strategy, I'm following this strategy. Boom. Feed them into the two computers, watch them play out their strategies, see what happens. If there are no random elements, there are going to be two numbers in that cell. One of them is how much I win, and one of them is how much you win. If there are random elements, we can then average over the probabilities and say if we played out these strategies a million times, you would win this amount, I'd win that amount. Does that make sense as a sort of a powerful abstract way of describing all two-player games? Some games, an interesting subset of games, are what are called zero-sum games.
So hold on a second. So if I understand this right, the strategies for an entire game would be contained in one cell?
The strategy would be contained in one column or one row. And the cell represents the intersection of player one's strategy and player two's strategy.
Okay, but I guess what I mean is that in any particular cell, you have enough each cell essentially represents a game and its outcome, where the strategies intersect.
That's right. So each cell represents one strategy by player one, one strategy by player two, and the game that happens if those two play those strategies.
Okay,
thanks. Yeah. It's a neat idea. It gets simpler and simpler sort of the more you get used to it, in a sense, but just as a powerful way of simplifying all games. And zero-sum games have the characteristic that whenever one player wins, the other one loses. So suppose you were looking at a cell. All right, we're going to look at one cell in one of these enormous, astronomically big matrices. And X is what player one wins. Y is what player 2 wins. If it's zero sum, what can we say about those numbers? If it's zero sum, is it possible that when we play the game out, I win $10 and you win $5?
One's zero and one's positive.
Okay. More than that.
One's positive, one's negative. They both wind up.
They're the same number, one of them is minus the other. Right? Might be 0, 0, might be 10 minus 10, you don't know.
All right.
I should say, sort of part of the bottom line of this is von Neumann solved all zero-sum two-player games in the mathematician sense, in the sense of telling you in principle how you would solve them, and with his definition of solution, which we'll get to in a little while. But let's take an example first, which is a game that I expect some of you may even have played at some point in your wasted youth, called Scissors, Paper, Stone. All right? Everybody knows Scissors, Paper, Stone already?
A.K.A. Paper, Rock, Scissors.
Paper, Rock, Scissors, yeah, whatever, same thing, right. The very simple game, two kids simultaneously throw out their hands, and it's either scissors, paper, or stone. scissors cuts paper, so the person with the scissors wins. Stone breaks scissors, so the person with the stone wins. Paper covers stone, so the person with the paper wins. Really simple game. And the way kids play, at least when I knew it, which doesn't seem to make any economic sense at all, is the winner gets to slap the loser. However, for game theory purposes, we will assume that the loser pays a dollar to the winner. And tie, there's no payment. And you can describe that. So this game has only one move, so the strategies are really simple. The strategy, well, a little less simple than they seem, but start out seeming simple. So this is a strategy matrix. Player one picks a column, player two picks a row. I can never remember what the conventional rule is as to which of the numbers in the cell comes first, so don't rely on my following the right rule, but basically if player one picks paper and player two picks scissors, player one loses one and player two gains one. I think you're supposed to reverse the order of those, but don't worry about it. And so forth through all of it. So you can see that all the cells sum to zero. Each cell sums to zero. Zero, zero, zero on the diagonal. Those are the ties. So that's sort of very, very simple example of a game matrix with a really trivial game. So the von Neumann then says, I'm going to define what a solution is for a two-player zero-sum game. And a solution is a pair of strategies, the description of a strategy for each player, and a value of the game, which you can think of as the value of the game for player one. And what is the characteristic of these strategies? If player one plays his strategy, he is guaranteed, on average, to get it. Whatever player two does, player one will get at least V. At least the value of the game to him. He might get more if player two does stupid things, but at least he's sure to get V. Player two's strategy guarantees that player one will never get more than V. Never again means averaged over many plays in the game, because there might be coin flips and things. All right. So we have a pair of strategies, one of which holds one player's score up to something, and the other plays his score down to the same thing. So we know that if player one is playing his strategy, player two can't do better than to play his, and if player two is playing his strategy, player one can't do better than to play his. And that's a definition of solution. It's a pretty good definition, although it does leave out the question of could you play a strategy to exploit other people's mistakes and such. That's the one that von Neumann used. And it turns out that von Neumann proved that every two-player zero-sum game had a solution in that sense. And in principle, how to solve it, given your unlimited computing power. And that seems sort of puzzling if you think about scissors, paper, stone, because if my strategy is paper, then scissors will always beat it, so it looks as though I can't avoid losing minus one, losing a dollar if I follow that strategy. Each of the other strategies, there's something the other guy could do which will guarantee him a win. So how can it be that there is a von Neumann solution? How can it be, and it's a symmetric game, so it can't be anybody who has a, it's obvious that the game is symmetric, the value is going to have to be zero, right? Isn't that sort of true? Intuitively obvious, because neither player has any advantage. So how is it possible? What would be a strategy for me that guarantees that on average I will get at least zero, whatever you do? Any guesses?
Always pick the same one.
Then I always get minus one, because the other guy will see what I'm picking and always pick the one that beats it.
Well, then you... Well... I guess that assumed that the other player was picking randomly. If you were playing somebody that didn't know your strategy, it was always to pick the same one.
The answer is that von Neumann includes in strategies what are called mixed strategies. And a mixed strategy means you introduce randomness. So that the solution to this game is to roll a die on one or two where the other player can't see the die. On a one or two, you play scissors, three or four paper, five or six stone. That's your randomized behavior. Can you see that if I do that, then on average, I will always get zero whatever strategy the other player plays? Is that clear? Because each play, whatever he's doing, I've got a one-third chance of gaining a dollar, a one-third chance of losing a dollar, and a one-third chance of breaking even. Yes? No? So that gives us the von Neumann solution to a very, very simple game. Von Neumann actually solves poker. He's got a very simplified two-player version of poker, but given that simplified version, he shows what the optimal strategy is. That's about where it stops. That's about Chapter 2 of Theory of Games and Economic Behavior by von Neumann and Morgenstern, of which my one piece of sort of private information on that book is that my father talked to Morgenstern a while after the book was published and congratulated him on it, and Morgenstern said that his role in writing that book was making sure that Johnny von Neumann worked on it for 2 hours every day. And I think Morgenstern's view of his role has increased since then, it being a very famous book, but at least that's what my father remembered his saying at the time. Von Neumann, I guess, is in some way sort of a hero of mine. He's an interesting guy. I think I may have in the book the quote from Wigner. Wigner is a Nobel Prize winning physicist who commented, there are two kinds of people in the world, Johnny von Neumann and the rest of us.
Yeah, it's a chapter.
Yeah. And the other one, I don't know if it was there or not, I don't think I knew it when I wrote that book, is by Enrico Fermi, a still more famous physicist, who meets von Neumann, and von Neumann goes off, and Fermi turns to one of his fellow physicists and says, you know, that man is cleverer than I am, just as I'm cleverer than you are. That one I've got out of Teller's, Edward Teller, guy who's sometimes referred to as the father of the H-bomb, another moderately famous physicist, who has quite interesting memoirs, and he knew von Neumann. The best story there is von Neumann and Teller's son, who was probably like 8 or 10 at the time, succeeded in solving the Santa Claus problem. I don't know if it's ever occurred to you, perhaps you're not as inquiring as these people are. The Santa Claus problem is, how can Santa Claus in one night deliver presents to that many kids? And the solution which von Neumann and Teller's son came up with was that on Christmas, the Easter Bunny has nothing to do. And on Easter, Santa Claus has nothing to do. So it must be the case that there's a deal between the two, where on Christmas, the Easter Bunny delivers half the presents for Santa, and on Easter, Santa delivers half the eggs for the Easter Bunny. And I just find it sort of pleasant, the picture of someone that smart who is willing to take himself that unseriously. Anyway, so von Neumann solves that problem, and he then spends the rest of the book in various attempts at solving the harder problems, which are non-fixed sum games and multiple player games. And why are they harder? In a non-fixed sum game, there are things I can do that make both of us worse off, or make both of us better off. And that means that you introduce a lot of strategic stuff, such as threats, bluffs, bargains, and the like. So that I say to you, I know that turning down your offer will make me worse off, but by God, if you don't make me a better offer, I will turn it down. That would be one example. And you can think of a lot of other things. When you bring in more than two players, you now have a whole new world, because you've got the possibility of coalitions, of he and I will play together to benefit us and hurt him. You've got bargaining, how much of what we make by hurting him do I get and how much do you get. Even if the whole game were zero sum, the sub-games, as it were, involving individual coalitions aren't, because the coalition can hope that all its members will benefit at the expense of other players and so forth. So both non-fixed and multiple player turn out to be much harder ones. And there are a variety of different attempts people have made. Von Neumann's solution was to consider an outcome in terms of how much every player ended up with at the end of the game. Imputation was the term he used for that. And he then says one outcome is dominated by another. If the set of people who end up with more doing better off in the first outcome than in the second is also a set of people who can make the first outcome happen. All right? So if you think about the example I'll get to later, because it's the simplest three-person game I know, is majority vote. All right? Three-person majority vote, we have a dollar. Majority vote on how the dollar is divided. Well, suppose the division I propose is Ann gets 50 cents, Bill gets 50 cents, Charles gets nothing. That one can be implemented by Ann and Bill. And it dominates any outcome in which both Ann and Bill get less than 50 cents. because Ann and Bill will prefer 50 cents to 30 cents or zero. Ann and Bill together can vote that one in, so therefore it dominates. And von Neumann's definition of a solution was a set of outcomes such that none of the ones in the solution dominate any other. They're sort of alternatives. And everything outside of the solution is dominated by at least one inside the solution. So that sort of doesn't get you very far, because there could be a whole lot of different outcomes in that solution, but it's somewhere. And as I say, in three-person majority vote, it turns out that the division, this is actually with $2, not with $1, where the first two people split the money evenly and leave out the third, where the first and the third do it, or where the second and third do it. All right. If you sort of try to think about majority vote, try to say what will happen, you see the problem is that when Ann and Bill agree we're going to divide it 50-50, Charles comes over to Ann and whispers, you know, Ann, wouldn't you rather have 60 cents than 50 cents? How about you and I vote for 60-40-0? And then, of course, Bill whispers to Charles, hey, Charles, why do you want to end up with only 40 cents when Ann gets 60 cents? How about you and I make it 50-50-0 and cut Ann out, and so forth forever. So that's the sense in which even a very simple game, it's hard to know what's going to happen. A different solution related to that, one which has been popular with economists since von Neumann, is what's called the core, and the core is a set of outcomes which are not dominated by any other outcome. So outcomes such that there is no outcome in which the set of people who prefer it can also make it happen. However, there are lots of games where the core is empty, where there is no such result. And then the one which has probably gotten the most use, because although it is less profound than any of the others, it's also more usable, is Nash equilibrium. And Nash equilibrium says each player takes the other player's strategies as given, so we're sort of avoiding the strategic part of strategic behavior, as it were, and decides what the best thing for him to do is. And it's a Nash equilibrium if every player is doing that successfully. So if each player can correct, truthfully say, given what they're doing, I'm doing the best thing for me. That's a Nash equilibrium. And there are a bunch of problems with that, although it's sort of a neat idea. To begin with, it assumes that everybody acts individually, because you might have a case where, given what all of you are doing, I'm making the best move for me, and so are you, but if you and I change together, we could both be better off. And there, my standard example is a bunch of convicts are escaping from death row. They come to the gate of the prison, and there, sitting in the gate of the prison, is our governor, with a gun with one bullet. And he says, all right, boys, who wants to cross that line first? What is the Nash equilibrium? The only Nash equilibrium in the game, as I've described, leaving aside, I'm taking as given the behavior of the guard. You've got to assume that the guard, for some reason, chooses to behave in this way. That the only Nash equilibrium for the prisoners is to go back to their cells, because if all the other prisoners are going to go back to their cells, then charging means I get killed. That's worse than whatever my chances are of an appeal or whatever. If anybody else is going to charge, then what I want to do is to stand still, let him take the bullet, and then I escape. So given whatever all the other people are doing, the equilibrium is for me not to charge, which means we all lose out. On the other hand, if me and my buddy can somehow agree we'll both charge, 50% chance of getting killed is better than 90% chance of getting executed, so we charge. So that's one example. Notice, by the way, that a Nash equilibrium need not be unique. That one of the very familiar examples of Nash equilibrium is driving on the right side of the road. All right? Given that all of you are driving on the right side of the road, it is very prudent for me to drive on the right side of the road. And given that all of us are doing it, it's very prudent for you to do it. But if everybody were driving on the left-hand side of the road, it would also be a Nash equilibrium. So that's a simple case where you've got two different Nash equilibrium. A further and somewhat subtler problem with Nash equilibrium is the problem of defining strategy. And the reason it's a problem is that I say I'm going to assume they stick to their strategy when I change what I do, and then I'm going to say among all the things I could do, which one is best for me. But what I do will affect what is possible for them to do. So that my standard example for this is the Nash equilibrium problem for oligopoly. So let's assume there are five firms in the industry. And Nash equilibrium says each of us is acting in the way that maximizes profit given what the other four are doing. And I say, but wait a minute. I am considering whether to raise my price or lower my price, or increase quantity, decrease quantity, same thing. And I say, well, look, if I produced an extra 10 widgets, I'm assuming everybody else keeps doing the same thing, but they can't. Because what everybody else is doing is selling a certain number of widgets at a certain price. If the market demand at the current price for widgets is for 1,000 widgets, of which, as it happens, each of us is selling 200 of them, if I produce 10 more widgets, the market is not going to absorb 10 more widgets at that price. So the other players will either have to cut output or cut the price. Hence, it is not possible for them to continue doing what they were doing before. Does that make sense? So therefore, in defining their strategy, we're going to have to decide whether their strategy is a price or a quantity. Suppose I say what I mean by Nash equilibrium is that each firm sets a price, and each firm says, truthfully, given the price everyone else is selling at, this is the optimal price for me to sell at. Can anybody see what the implication of that's going to be? Let's suppose the cost of producing widget is $5. Currently, everybody is charging $10, making out like bandits. And I'm a firm, and I say, they're all charging $10. What should I charge? I can produce as many widgets as I like at $5. What price should I charge? Well, $9.99, let's be greedy. All right? If I'm charging $9.99, what price should he be charging? And if he's charging $9.98, all right? You see the logic of it. That if you define it as a price, this is called Bertrand competition, as it turns out. Automatically, the only equilibrium is cost. Any price above cost, it always pays any firm to charge a little less than that. On the other hand, if equilibrium is quantity, if what I say is each of us is producing 200, what happens when I produce 10 more? Everybody else could keep producing 200. The market price would fall a little bit. And you can analyze that problem. It's a much more complicated problem, it turns out, than the one I just did. And you can get a solution if you make assumptions about demand curves and such. And it's not cost. So that's a case where just how you decide to define what you mean by strategy gives you different outcomes. So those are all problems with Nash equilibrium. It's still popular because at least you can do it. There's another approach which has gotten increasingly popular in the last few decades called subgame perfect equilibrium. And this is for a sequential game. We're now dropping the matrix approach and we're saying, let's think of a game, and it's easiest to think of a two-player game that you can do with no more two players, but it's no longer a zero-sum two-player game. It's a game where I make a decision, you observe that, and you make a decision, I observe that, and I make a decision, and so forth. So you could think of the game as a sort of a tree diagram, where we start here, and I could do this or this. If I do this, you can do that, that, or that, and so forth. All right. It makes sense as a way of describing that kind of a game. I'll show you a picture of a very simple one that most of you will someday end up playing, I suspect, in a little bit. In fact, it's the game I'm about to do. And then there's a simple solution, it turns out. This is what subgame perfect equilibrium is. Subgame perfect equilibrium says, look at the last branches on the tree. Look at the point when we get to here and player one, this fork is player one making a decision. It's the end. And there's a payoff. And the payoff is 10, 6 for this outcome. That's player 1 gets 10, player 2 gets 6, and it's 8, 7, let us say, for that outcome. If we get to this fork, what is player 1 going to do? Pick the other one. So we can just forget about that, it doesn't matter. But that means that when we get to the fork before that, which is a player 2 fork, player 2 says, don't have to worry about that. If I go this way, that's where I'm going to end up. If I go this way, do the same thing. So the way you solve for subgame perfect equilibrium, just start at the right, and each fork, you lop off the one where the person choosing at that point gets the worst result. That tells you what happens. That's no longer a fork anymore. Go back and do the same thing. You can't just run all the way back and get an answer. So it's really a very, very simple and sort of intuitively plausible-seeming kind of approach for games that have that structure. However, to see why it's not quite as convincing as it at first seems, consider the put-to-bed game. This is the one which, assuming that you people are lucky enough to have children, which in my view is a great thing to do. Of course, they have to be wonderful children like mine, but then you'll think yours are. And the game goes as follows. You're having a dinner party, and your six-year-old or whatever, five-year-old, wants to stay up because he likes the party, likes being the getting attention from grown-ups, likes nibbling on the appetizers, stuff like that, and it's bedtime. And so you tell the child you have to go to bed, and the child says, I don't want to go to bed, and if you make me go to bed, I'll throw a tantrum. Doesn't say that, but acts in ways that clearly imply that. And if the child will in fact throw a tantrum, let us assume the payoffs are such that the various inconveniences that come from letting the child stay up and distract and maybe eventually be short of sleep and fussy and so forth, that those are less bad than the consequences of having your child throw a tantrum in her bedroom, which is within earshot of the living room where all your friends are gathered having their nice dinner party. So you say, if the child is going to throw a tantrum, I ought to let her stay up instead. That's better. But, on the other hand, from the child's standpoint, if you think of it that way, you say, if the parent's going to put me to bed, throwing a tantrum does no good. It just means that I end up unhappy and yelling and my dad's mad at me and won't give me ice cream tomorrow or something. So, if the child's going to throw a tantrum, if put to bed, the parent should not put the child to bed. If the parent is going to put the child to bed, the child should not throw a tantrum. All right? And the logic seems to be, if we believe subgame perfect equilibrium, it's perfectly clear. You just look at that picture and we say, what happens? We get to the to-bed stage, and the child's payoff from throwing a tantrum is minus 10, from not throwing a tantrum is minus 5. They're both minus because what the child really wants, of course, is to not go to bed and not throw a tantrum. All right. So therefore, the child won't throw a tantrum. Won't throw a tantrum here either, of course. But the parent would much rather have the plus 10 there than the minus 5 here. So the parent says, all right, we can lop off the tantrum branch on both of these. Since I can lop off the tantrum branch, now to bed takes us to there, and not to bed takes us to there. I prefer this one, so therefore I put the child to bed. All right. You see how subgame perfect equilibrium gives an absolutely clear and unambiguous answer to this question. And if by any chance there are any game theorists who are also parents, they will rapidly discover by the experimental method that the answer isn't true. That is, they will sometimes put the kid to bed under these circumstances when the kid throws a tantrum. What's going on is not that game theory is wrong, but that subgame perfect equilibrium is assuming away commitment strategies. And commitment strategies matter a whole lot in repeated games. So suppose you are the rational kid, and your father has just shown you this diagram and said, look, so I can slash off these branches, therefore you're not going to throw a tantrum, so you're not going to throw a tantrum, I'm going to put you to bed. What is the kid's response? What? Sure. The father says to the kid, I know you're threatening to throw a tantrum, but look, here's this diagram. I've got it right out of my book. And the diagram shows that if I put you to bed, it doesn't pay you to throw a tantrum. It does you no good. So you're not going to throw a tantrum if I put you to bed. If I don't put you to bed, you're not going to throw a tantrum either. I'd rather have you put to bed instead of having to put up with you during this evening, during the party, so I'm going to put you to bed, and you're not going to throw a tantrum. And what is the kid's response? The kid's response is, Daddy, you don't understand commitment strategies. That I am going to get myself into such an angry mood about being unfairly cheated of the fun of wandering around your dinner party, having everybody tell me how cute I am and sneak me appetizers that I'm not supposed to get, maybe a few candies too. I'll be so mad about missing that I just won't be able to stop myself from having a tantrum. And because you'll know that I'm going to be like that, you're not going to put me to bed, are you, Daddy? All right? So it's in the context of a repeated game, what torpedoes subgame perfect equilibrium is the commitment strategy, the realization that by making sure you will, that if one can commit himself to go down the branch that doesn't pay, at some earlier stage, that may give the other person an incentive to make a choice that leads to the better alternative for one. Does that make sense? Yes? No?
All right. So that's why subgame perfect equilibrium is sort of neat if you're imagining a nice, simple one-play game, but the world mostly isn't like that, and most of us are repeat players in the games of life, and therefore kids do throw tantrums, and they're right to throw tantrums from their standpoint, given their particular interests. Some other games that we'll be discussing. One of them, which is actually very much like the game we've just described, though in a different form, is bilateral monopoly, where I have the only apple and only you want apples. If I sell you the apple, that's a $1 gain. It's worth a dollar to you and nothing to me. But in order for that to happen, we have to agree on a price. I would like to sell it to you for 99 cents, because then I get 99 cents of the $1 gain. You would like to buy it for 1 cent, because you get 99 cents of the gain, and it's not clear what's going to determine where between those we end up. But if we can't reach an agreement, the gain disappears. Prisoner's Dilemma. Have all of you heard Prisoner's Dilemma before? Is this sufficiently a part of? Is there anybody who's never heard of Prisoner's Dilemma, raise your hand. All right. So you all know it, or at least have been told it. Maybe not you know it. And the basic logic is very simple. Two prisoners are arrested for a crime they committed together, and the DA goes to each of them separately and says, look, if you confess and he doesn't, I'll treat you very leniently. If neither of you confesses, I won't be able to convict you for that crime, but there are some lesser included offenses I can get you for, and I'll do as much as I can to you for those, so you'll be better off. If he doesn't confess, you're better off double-crossing him, and then I'll let you off with a token punishment, then you're staying silent and you'll both get a more than token punishment. And furthermore, if he confesses and you don't confess, I'm not only going to convict you, I'm going to ask for the stiffest punishment I can possibly get for that offense. Whereas if you both confess, I'll convict you, but I'll let you off with sort of a somewhat later punishment. So the logic of that is that my confessing helps me a little bit and hurts the other criminal a lot. His confessing helps him a little, hurts me a lot. It's therefore in the interest of both of us to confess, and we're both worse off than if we both kept our mouths shut. Everybody understand that sort of counterintuitive result? Bilateral monopoly, simple two-player non-fixed sum game, hence threats, bargains, and bluffs. I won't give you more than 25 cents. I won't take less than 75 cents. Risk of bargaining breakdown, child throws a tantrum, apples, and so on. One way of winning is a commitment strategy. How many people here are familiar with the Doomsday Machine? It was the central protagonist of Dr. Strangelove. Non-human protagonist of Dr. Strangelove. Doomsday Machine is an idea that Herman Kahn came up with, not as a policy proposal, but as a way of understanding the existing situation. And the Doomsday Machine works as follows. The U.S. builds a bunch of really dirty hydrogen bombs. Hydrogen bombs deliberately engineered to produce as much fallout as possible. And it's a lot of trouble getting those bombs to Russia, so we just bury them in the Rocky Mountains instead. And we have a detonating device such that if there is a Soviet nuclear attack on the U.S., these bombs all go off. They do some minor damage to the Rocky Mountains, and incidentally, they kill off all life on Earth because of all the fallout. That was the theory of the Doomsday Machine. You can see why he calls it a Doomsday Machine. And we tell the Russians about this, and so the Russians now know that they can't make a nuclear attack on the U.S., so we don't have to worry about Star Wars and anti-missile defenses and all the rest of that stuff. We can sort of retire large parts of our military, at least down to the level of conventional warfare. That was the Doomsday Machine. And I should say, Kahn also proposed the Doomsday in a Hurry Machine, which is the same thing, except that there are additional events that will trigger it, such as the Soviets seizing West Berlin, and now we can get rid of most of our conventional army too, because the Soviets know if they do any of various things we don't like, the world will end. That's the Doomsday Machine.
And in Doctor Strangelove, the Russians have built a doomsday machine, but they have imprudently postponed the announcement because they're waiting for the premier's birthday. And while they're waiting, a mad American Air Force commander launches a thermonuclear attack on the Soviet Union. Now, I should say the plot is stolen from a book called Red Alert, which I thought was a better story, because in that one, the Air Force commander is a sympathetic character. He is somebody who was in Eastern Europe when the Russians came in killing and raping at the end of World War II. He is a highly intelligent professional who has worked out that the Russians are gradually gaining on the U.S., and his opinion is that we're approaching the last point at which a first strike by the U.S. can succeed, can wipe out enough of the Russian military so that the retaliation will not be devastating. And so he cleverly rigs things so that his Air Force wing, which is the biggest single collection of bombers, is going to go in and can't be recalled. He informs the rest of the Air Force what he has done when they can't stop it but still have time to send in their planes as well, and he then commits suicide in order to make sure that nobody can make him do anything to change it. So as I say, I think to my mind he's actually a sympathetic character. He's willing to kill, you know, 80 million people, but he's willing to kill himself too. He just thinks the cause is worth that much. Anyway, in Dr. Strangelove, as I say, it works out rather differently. So Doomsday Machine is an interesting example, because that's, what is the Doomsday Machine? Khan wasn't proposing we build it, he was pointing out we had built it. All right, that was his stylized version of mutual assured destruction. Two Doomsday Machines, that basically the U.S. retaliating against a nuclear strike, if you believe that a nuclear strike will really completely wipe out the country. It's not clear that was true, but that was what a lot of people thought. If you believe that, our retaliation is futile. In fact, it's a bad thing to do. It'll put even more fallout in the air. And besides, if we're really going to be wiped out, better the